It was Frank Drake on 27 April 79. Until the 300 foot came along, when was that, the second dish?
Yeah, the 300 foot was the second dish. And along the way, there was a long tale of misfortune, the 140 foot dish.
Can you sort of outline this? First of all, I didn't realize that the primary motivation for the equatorial knot, you said, was rigidity.
No. The decision to build a 140 foot as an equatorial was made after a lot of soul searching. There was a choice had to be made between alta azimuth and equatorial. And after a lot of study, it was decided that the computers of that time were not good enough to control an alta azimuth mount reliably. Whereas we hadn't had a lot of experience with equatorial mounts. And I should say the fact that all the people from the Harvard group had some influence, because both of the dishes that had been built at Harvard were equatorial mounts.
Right.
And people felt very comfortable with them and very confident with them. And as a result, there was a bias towards equatorial mounts anyway.
Right.
But when it was decided that computers were unreliable and possibly would not give sufficient pointing accuracy, we went for an equatorial.
Yeah, analog methods such as was used in the Parks dish. I mean, you must have looked into the whole Parks sort of design.
No, the Parks design was never considered. The only thing that was considered were digital computers.
Right.
No analog design was ever discovered. The equatorial mount, of course, avoids the computer problem, but it has other serious problems, such as the direction of the forces on the declination bearings changing as the telescope moves. Similarly, the gravitational load vectors on the fork, which holds the dish, changing as the dish loads, and things like that, which make, in fact, an equatorial mount a much more difficult thing to design than an alta azimuth, which few people realize. The result was that the designs for the 140 foot were extremely massive to get rigidity, and they had a very difficult problems of bearings, and the whole thing compounded because the more weight you added to give stiffness, the greater the problem with the bearings and so forth. And it had an oil pad bearing which had never been built before with a spherical bearing surface, 14 feet in diameter, many things which were very difficult and quite unique. And lots of bad things happened, such as on the day the contract was to be signed at Green Bank for the construction of a 140-foot telescope. And all the big wheels and such from AUI and NSF were there, all rushing to a meeting at Green Bank. The most unlikely thing and horrible thing in the world happened. That was, there was a head-on collision between the chief engineer of AUI and the car being driven by the wife of the president of AUI.
Out in West Virginia?
Yeah, right on the road near Green Bank. Terrible head-on collision in which the engineer was killed. And the whole meeting had to break up. We had to go out and clean the debris off the road and take the people to the hospital. It was not clear whether the wife of the president of AUI had been killed or not. She was in very bad shape and was rushed off to the hospital. We all had to go charging down her, not knowing whether she was alive or dead, etc.
She's
awful.
How long did that delay things then?
Well, the documents actually got signed that day.
Oh, they did get signed, yes.
Yeah,
it was an omen.
All the parties and ceremonies
right.
That went by the boards. And it all happened at an intersection where there were about five accidents and up by Dunmore.
What were some of the other things that...
Well, then after the telescope was half constructed, it was a great expense. It was discovered that the metal that was being used in the polar axis and the fork was subject to brittle fracture. This business that destroyed many ships during World War II, where certain kinds of metal, when subjected to temperatures of 10 below zero or so, become brittle with their strength and shatter like glass. And the temperatures do get that low at Green Bank, and it was only discovered after the pieces were all made, in fact, at Green Bank, that the metal was subject to brittle fracture. And all the material that had been built for the telescope had to be discarded and had to start over.
Mm.
We actually had the stuff there. original polar axis is buried. You couldn't even scrap or haul it out of
it. So it's buried right near the present telescope?
It's buried, like a buried monument next to the existing telescope.
Some archaeologists will find it.
Yeah, and I wonder, what on earth is this, another polar axis?
How was that discovered?
I mean, it was discovered by some consulting engineers reviewing the design. This was years after the design existed, the contracts existed, the things half built, millions of dollars.
But why were they called in to review the design?
I'm not sure. I don't remember that history. Maybe I knew it once. This raised the price from $4 million to $13
million. Oh, wow.
Telescope.
Because of the delay in time?
Delay in time, the need to use more expensive steel, the fact that you had to start over.
And how much of a delay in time would you say it ended up being?
2 or 3 years. All of that.
So that was the major thing, really.
The brittle fracture thing was the major delay.
Any others?
No other major things.
No other major.
Major enough. Right. I had to throw away the whole telescope. The rest of it. All right. Now, in 61, about... No, 61, we got the idea we should build a bigger telescope anyway. And we came up with the idea of a 300-foot transit instrument. We wanted it to be 300 feet because that was a nice big number. And we decided it should be a transit instrument just to save money. And we proposed to the NSF to build a 300-foot transit instrument. And the NSF's response was that it was very interesting. And that was that they would give us $1 million to build a 300-foot transit instrument, and not a penny more. It had to be 300 feet, and it was to be $1 million, and those were the guidelines and the boundary conditions.
You think the 300 had to do with the Gyro Bank 250?
Yeah, it had to be bigger than Gyro Bank, and it had to be an impressive number. And that's pretty much how the size got set. And then there was $1 million. And the result was that the telescope was designed to meet those figures, with the peculiar consequence, which nobody understands today, that the declination coverage is limited. And what happened there was, we designed the telescope with various tower heights and zenith angle swings, and got cost bids. And what we discovered was that if the thing was to be able to tilt all the way over to the horizon, it would cost more than $1 million. And so we just kept lowering the tower heights until the cost reached $1 million, and that is how the declination coverage of the telescope was set.
In fact, you had to dig a hole to...
Yeah, and actually we did the compromise, or found a way of getting maximum coverage at minimum cost, which involved short towers and digging a hole in the ground. So the dish, the south rim of the dish actually goes into the hole in the ground. And that's why the dish ended up going to minus 20 declination. It has the short towers and uses cables and all other kinds of money savings.
Right. And but in fact, of course, it was a fantastic design in terms of output for money.
Oh, yeah. It was
cost effectiveness
was very high. The telescope was a great success.
Right? I mean, it's tremendously, to me, in contrast to the 140-foot.
Yeah. The 140-foot costs 13 times as much.
And has produced some interesting science once it got going, but
it was probably about the same overall.
Yeah, but it's a real problem.
Best you
can measure that, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I always associate John Finley with the design of the 300-foot.
Yes, John Finley was in charge of the design of the 300-foot. And he worked very closely with a fellow in Buffalo named Ed Felton. He was a guy who just designed things in his basement. And the design was actually... made by Ed Felton, but Finley and he worked together closely and provided each other with insights and ideas, like the use of cables where members were always going to be on the attention, and shortening the towers and using the hole in the ground, and all that stuff. But it was really the product of those two people.
And it only took, a year to build itself?
It took 1 year to build.
Okay, now we're getting a little bit ahead. Let's go back to when you arrived at Green Bank, and you said that Dave Heeshan was there, and was he the only
he was the only other astronomer.
Scientist or engineer?
Yeah, he was the only one. There was one technician, and shortly thereafter we got a visitor from Norway, a short-term visitor named Hang Bottom.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes.
And that was the whole staff for quite a while. After about a year, Cam Wade showed up. I don't really remember the
But Haynes stayed on.
Well, Haynes stayed a year, and he went back to Norway.
For how long?
He went back for about a year to Norway, but he had loved Greenback. He just loved that whole scene. And he got along very well there, and so as fast as we could get him back and get a visa, he came back and has stayed, of course, as the project manager for the VLA and all that.
I haven't talked to him yet, but he's on my list.
Yeah, he's got some interesting stories. But anyway, that was the nucleus, and those were the people who built the 85-foot. And by the time the 300-foot was built, there were quite a few more people around. There were the Lins, Roger Lins, and Beatty Lins, and Cam Wade. I don't remember who all
was. Was Menon there then?
No.
Mort Roberts?
There. No, Mort Roberts.
Still in the room?
He came around 64.
Let me just ask, I should have asked when you were talking about the Doc Ewan 8,000 megahertz receiver and yourself also. In the Stars and Stellar Systems Volume 1 article that you wrote, you talk about it as University of Michigan, University of California, NRAO 8,000 megacycle.
Yeah, receiver. That's because after the first one was built and successfully used at Ewan Knight, all those three places built copies. They bought copies.
Bought copies.
Yeah, those were all copies, exact copies that were bought from Ewan Knight.
And I assume that he never really was able to sell them wholesale to the Navy.
They were sold and
they were used,
but always in classified applications.
Which are still classified? Or?
If you
turn it off. Okay, back to Greenback. So what were you mainly concerned with in the year before the dish was built?
Well, in the year before, we were actually transferring the technology that we'd had before to Greenback. We bought one of Ewan Knight's 8 gigahertz receivers. We bought an Inductasyn system for pointing on the 85-foot telescope. We bought a digital computer, a special-purpose digital computer to use with the Inductasyn so that we could have printouts of positions. And the idea was to be very precise.
Well, that was really state-of-the-art at that time, to be buying computers for that sort of thing.
Yeah. It's all tubes, 10,000 tubes.
Who made that?
A little company in Boston called Control Equipment Corporation. I think soon after went defunct. It was actually a spinoff from Ewan Knight, a little company.
Was there not also a general purpose computer at
Greenback very early? We also introduced the first general purpose computer ever in astronomy. In a step-by-step way, when the first 85-foot was built, one of the first things we did was to try to digitize the output, which we did in the simplest possible way, which was to get a digital voltmeter with red voltages on Nixie tube.
Yeah.
And the first such application required the telescope operator to sit there and write down the numbers.
That was your digital output, yeah.
Yeah.
These were then punched up later?
Yeah, or whatever.
Yeah.
Actually, usually analyzed just by reading them off by eye. And then soon after that, we got a printer that you could connect to this thing that would print the output, so you actually got a printed version, which was on a tape like a cash register in a grocery store. And the first visitor to Greenback ever to use that system was Gart Westerhout, and he quickly automated it by tying a string to the read button so that he could sit in a chair, and he would watch the Nixie tubes, and when the thing was reading something reasonable, he'd pull on the string like he was flushing the toilet from the printer to print. That was the first digital system in astronomy, in radio astronomy, I guess in all astronomy. And soon after that, we decided we should get a real computer, and so we got what was then a small, scientifically oriented computer, which was an IBM 610.
Early
model that was all relays and tubes. And you programmed it by plugging wires into a board.
Right.
And you couldn't have more than about 100 program steps. And otherwise, the only input-output was a bunch of paper tape. And we used that thing for about a year. But that turned out to be a real revelation. We really got the digital computer started. That was the first one, as far as I know, in all of astronomy.
It was sort of like what we would call now just a
a simple $20 calculator in terms of what it could do.
It wasn't even as good as the present handheld calculators.
Well, maybe the very simplest ones, though.
Yeah, but it was slower.
It was slower.
And
it didn't have trig functions.
It had no built-in functions at all. And it had, I think, maybe 300 memory steps, or program steps max.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. So when we saw how really what a big help even that thing was, we quickly got another computer, and I can't even remember what the name of that one was. It was made by a small computer company, which is now gone defunct. It was much more powerful, and but you had to program it in machine language. And so we all had to learn machine language, which was both a challenge, but in fact, the programs were great step ahead in their power over what we had before.
Do you think that this automation was important in terms of the success in Green Bank? Was it just a convenience?
Well, it played several roles. It was a convenience. It really did expedite things, but also it created excitement at the observatory to be trying out all these new things.
Mm-hmm.
It was a source of good morale and motivation to have all these wonderful toys. We had that one computer, I can't remember its name, for only 6 months or so, because then we moved on to a super new model from IBM, which was the 1620.
That used cards.
Yeah, that one used cards.
I actually used that in 65 NRL for summarizing there. You had to read in the compiler separately.
Yeah, but that was really the first of the sort of modern style.
And used Fortran.
Used Fortran. Yeah, that one used Fortran. That was the first one we had that used Fortran.
And that came along when?
That came in, must have been 62.
Let's go back to the first observations that you did on the 85. But what did you think were the things to do with this dish?
Well, the first things, of course, we did was calibrate it. And then, to me, one of the first things one should look at was the galactic center. So we had what was then a much improved beam width over anything that existed. So we looked at the galactic center and discovered it was resolved in a whole bunch of sources, things that are now known as Sagittarius A and Sagittarius B.
You talked about four sources here in one paper.
The
four primary sources.
That's right.
Here we are, Sky and Telescope. This is the AAS.
That's right. Those are the sources that nowadays are known as Sagittarius A, Sagittarius B, and the others.
A West? Oh, no, you didn't have those.
No, A was not resolved, and B was not resolved. And then there were the two outlying sources. I don't even know if they have them.
I don't think they have specific names, but
I'm looking up here at the map. The four of them are there.
This is a 2-centimeter map, really.
That's a 140-foot map later. But the four from 85 are the four you see up there. One's A and one's B and the other two.
I don't think they have specific names now.
Yeah, I remember an interesting thing there was that Struve had taken over as director by then.
What was the director? Berkner was director?
Berkner was director until Struve came.
But Berkner had never done any astronomy.
No, he was an ionospheric guy, originally. It was his wife that was in the auto accident. And he never participated in science. He was just did the director's chores while we found the proper director. And of course, the history there was that they did recruit Joe Pausi, which was a very good step. And Joe came to Green Bank and came down with a brain tumor while he was there, which is a whole other story.
Well, I've heard it from an Australian's point of view and so forth, but that would have indeed changed the history rather much undoubtedly if he had become director.
Yeah.
No,
He came to Green Bank. He was full of good ideas, very enthusiastic. He came to spend a month or so, and he was going back to Australia and pack up and come back and take over the job. And he came for about a month and was full of good ideas and being very stimulating to the staff. And he knew a lot more than the rest of us about things, particularly about interferometers and stuff like that, because he really invented aperture synthesis, if you check the literature. He was the first one to recognize the significance of the Fourier transform, the way of describing an image. Yeah, I remember one day I went in to talk to him about something scientific. I don't remember what it was now. I was in to talk to him. He said, Frank, something's funny. What? I'm asymmetrical. today. One leg works different from the other. And actually, in just a few days, it got bad. And he went to, he was told he should go to a hospital. And they were checking him into a hospital, and they diagnosed him with multiple sclerosis. And actually, after a few weeks, he got better. And he actually came back to Green Bank and completed his visit, and then he got really bad. He got almost paralyzed on one side quite suddenly. So they shipped him off to Boston, operated on him, all of that. And actually, they never told him he had terminal cancer. There was no hope. And right to the end, he thought he was going to recover and come to be director of Green Bank. And nobody was telling. His wife didn't want him told. The result was we couldn't recruit for another director. So he actually went back to Australia. And as far as he was concerned, when he got well, he was going to come to Green Bank. Actually, he lingered for a year.
So that delayed things.
And AUI brought in, got its trustees to look into the thing. One of them was Struve. And after a lot of hemming and hawing, they decided they should make Struve the director. And he was very reluctant to take the job because he thought he wasn't really qualified. But he thought it was his duty as an astronomer. So he came and became director of Green Bank. And he was always uncomfortable.
This is such an opposite approach from Pawsey, who knew every bit about antennas and interferometry and so forth, to someone who knew the astronomy, but nothing about the technique.
Well, he was an eminent astronomer. He had experience in running an observatory. But he knew nothing of the techniques or really much about the science at all. And I remember one thing he said when he came was that he thought radio astronomy had no future. It would all be done and finished in a few years unless we found a variable radio sources.
And then you can monitor it forever.
Variable radio source, then you could monitor it forever. I remember that was his assessment of the situation in radio astronomy. Another thing I remember was when we dissolved the galactic center, I took the data in and showed it to him. He said, well, that one result justifies the whole cost of this place. He was thrilled. I guess he never imagined that you would ever see the galactic center in detail as an optical astronomer.
Right.
It was this thing covered by dust. And here was actually a detailed picture of it.
Now, I guess it was understood that he was only going to be around for 2 or 3 years before he would retire.
Yeah, that's right.
Sort of an interim.
It was an interim thing until he retired. And when he retired, when Dave was the director.
But anyway, back to what you wanted to do with the planets. So you measured the galactic center matter.
And then I was interested in planets.
Which was the highest frequency it had been done at before. It had been recognized by the Australians.
But it had not been resolved.
Right.
It had been seen at many frequencies, but not just being at this high frequency. So then I was interested in planets, particularly because Connie Mayer was getting these weird results on Venus at the high temperature. And so we did a big, long program on Venus. It was all written up where we got the phase function and established that the temperature was high. And then we also heard that Russell Slonaker at NRL was looking at Jupiter and seeing the high temperature there. And that intrigued us. So we turned the 85 foot on that, and that was seen bottom.
This is at 10, 20 centimeters.
Slonaker was seeing 600 degrees at 10 centimeters.
Right.
Which was the same as Venus, which was the same temperature, same wavelength, which was kind of amazing. So we thought, well, we'll see, is it the Venus situation all over again? So we booked at 1420 because we had that frequency. This was Hain Bottom. And we got a much higher temperature. We had 3,000 degrees. And then, intrigued by that, we instrumented the thing at 440 megahertz. And looked there, and there we got 13,000 degrees. So we had this non-thermal spectrum, which was all very exciting. And so we published it and suggested that Jupiter had radiation belts. A little aside to that story, not a very nice one, is that just as we were doing that, we had the high temperatures. John Bolton visited Green Bank, and he was wondering what was going on. I said, gee, we got this really exciting thing. I showed him the data on Jupiter. Look, Jupiter has this fantastically high flux density and what looks like a non-thermal spectrum. So, and he left. And the next thing we knew was just at the time we published, suddenly a paper came out of Caltech, which was Radhakrishnan Roberts, I guess.
That's right.
Reporting the discovery of this hyflux from Jupiter. I thought that was very funny, and later I asked Radhakrishnan, you know, what caused you to do that? He said, well, you know, John Bolton came back from that trip he made to the East, and he said, you know, you might just go out and take a look at Jupiter. You might find something interesting. And so he stole that result in that very funny way. That was a real shocker to me, because you hear those things happening, and that was it, actually.
And they, in fact, did get into print before you did?
I think they did.
Now, were you having trouble getting these results accepted at all by the planetary astronomers?
No.
Because I know that with Venus, I talked to Connie Mayer, that they thought there must be something wrong. You know, the radio people didn't really know what they were, interpret their own data.
It certainly never bothered us. We just published.
Yeah. But you don't remember any conflicts. So.
No, I don't remember anyone ever getting upset. There were no angry letters or anything.
And what made you think of the radiation belts? I suppose it was the Jupiter activity, the decametric activity, which was...
No, it was non-thermal spectrum. We knew about that synchrotron radiation. And the fact that the terrestrial Van Allen belts had just been recently discovered. That was big news.
Yes, that's right. That would be influencing.
Big news.
But now the polarization was picked up by Radhakrishnan.
Yeah,
was that a bit later?
No, that was...
Was that that same first paper?
The same first paper was the polarization and the fact that the source was larger than...
You hadn't checked for the polarization yourself?
No, we had not thought to do that. We had no way of measuring the size. All we could do was the spectrum.
Right, they were using the interferometer at Owens Valley.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was the planetary work. Now... Before we get to OSMA, was there any other projects on the 85 foot that...
Not that I was...
I don't see any other.
I did just the Planetary and Galactic Center.
So, that brings us to Project OSMA. Can you tell me, first of all, have you always had an interest in the idea of communicating with another civilization? I mean, right back to high school or something? Or?
Oh yeah, that interest goes way back. Not that it was a burning interest, it was a casual one like almost anybody. I wasn't a great science fiction buff or anything like that. But all I know is that when we finally started building the 85-foot telescope, it just occurred to me to sit down one day and calculate how far away it could detect a reasonable signal, from what distance.
Right.
And it came out to be light years.
You had had an interest before, but you'd never actually done any back-of-the-envelope calculations
anything
like this?
Nothing until that time. Nothing until there was really an 85-foot on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So I made the calculation and discovered that if we went fairly narrow band, we could reach 10 light years or so and detect signals like those of the strongest terrestrial signals. And one day we went to lunch with Berkner. It was a custom at Green Bank then for everybody to eat together. There was no cafeteria or anything. We used to go to a diner at the a place that's halfway to Bartow, in a little town.
Yeah.
Hamlet, you go through on Route 28. We went there for lunch one day. It was Dave and John Findlay and Berkner. And I just mentioned, I've done this calculation, isn't that interesting? And Berkner said, well, maybe you ought to do something about that. I said, well, I'd like to try that. And they said, all we have to do is build a narrowband system, and if we're clever about it, it can be used to measure Zeeman effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, that's how the whole thing got started.
And for a transmitter power, what you were assuming?
I don't remember now, but it was whatever existed in those days.
Yeah. And then you've actually told this story in some detail in that Cosmic Search article.
Yeah.
And then the paper by Coconi and Morrison arrived. Well, that you were
was
preparing.
Long after, because we started, there was snow on the ground, that's what I remember that day, so it had to be in the spring of 59, and we decided we were going to do it, and we proceeded very slowly, because it was done on the side. In fact, a lot of the equipment construction was built by a visitor who came from England that summer, which was putting together the equipment. So that summer we were building it, and Struve had taken over then.
Do you remember his name?
Ross Meadows. He's a visitor from Slough, and he spent the summer on sort of a sabbatical building and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognized right away that if anybody found out we were doing this, we'd be hounded by newspeople. So we had a policy of not saying a word about it. Then in late, I guess, the Morrison County was September, October,